Yes, we are going to talk about the right. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and this is when I remind my listening audience that we still have a pathological liar and a 34 count convicted felon in the White House. That man is shredding the Constitution. He is making government dysfunctional and he is turning us against each other. So, woke is not a bad state of mind to be in right about now, y'all. We got to be woke because they are throwing stuff at us left and right. And also, this is the time when I remind you that genocide is still going on in Gaza. And just recently, there have been a few journalists that have been killed as a result of some of these assaults. And this is critical because there have been like 200 journalists killed in Gaza since 2023. The Zionists have not wanted any journalists to be inside of Gaza to record, to chronicle what's going on there. So they are being targeted as if they are part of Hamas. And they really aren't. Many of these are independent journalists. So, it's when you start attacking the free press, and we see it even in this country, the free press is going out the window. They've been at being attacked by Trump and his minions. So let's just keep an eye on that. But the reminder is that what's going on in Gaza, what Trump is doing, including bringing a war criminal to the shores of this country. If Putin had went anywhere else, he would have been arrested on the spot because he has been indicted by the international world court. And so why is he here except that one dictator to another? So again, let's just be mindful that our dollars are flying over there to Israel to fund the genocide of the Palestinian people. So, having said that, we are going to talk about some assaults on workers and on unions that are coming from the White House and the MAGA movement. And it's not like we shouldn't have known that it was coming, because guess what? It was all laid out in Project 2025, which came out in 2024. So, this man has given us the blueprint by which he's going to undermine, destroy, assault, attack what we hold dear. And unions is what all of us on this call hold dear. We've either all been union members or we definitely support workers' rights. So I'm going to introduce my guest today, Percy Green II, who is a legend in his own right. All what he has done has been about good paying jobs. So climbing the arch to highlight the fact that there were no black construction workers on that federal project. And many people may know about that because it seems very theatrical, but they don't know enough about Green versus McDonnell Douglas, which was one of the landmark cases to prove racial discrimination. Also, we have Ashley Bolden, who is organizer, but she's also the deputy director at Missouri Jobs for Justice and out there always doing her thing. And we have Tiffany McPherson, who is with the American Federation of Government Employees, and she's a vice president here, but nationally she's holding it down for the women in the union. And so we're glad to have all of you all here today. So I'm going to start with Jefferson Banks because that's how we build this, because this would have been a day, or the 28th is the day that the Jefferson Bank protest happened. And for folks who don't know, I'm just going to say there's enough out there, but just briefly, it was a exposing of the lack of black workers at Jefferson Bank. And at that time, there's hardly any black folks working at banks. Although we were putting our money there, we were not bank tellers. We definitely were not executive in anything as it had to do with management. And so that became a focal point. And I do want to say that Congressman Bill Clay was one of the original 19, and he recently passed at 94. So it makes me realize that it's not very many left of the original 19, but there was a legion of folks around there that supported that case, and there were protests day after day after day until the bank relented. And once they did that, afterwards there were commemorative protests every year at the same time, so that we always remembered what that struggle was about, but also about whatever struggles were going on. And it's always worker struggles going on. And so I'm going to just throw this to you, Percy. What do you think is the legacy of the Jefferson Banks, and why was it a decision to put it to rest and look at another way of lifting workers up?
Well, I think the legacy of Jefferson Bank is pretty much the sharp treatment that it brought to bear upon the white power structure here in this area, in the city of St. Louis. That being where you had middle class blacks and the working class blacks coming together on a common issue. And that was precipitated as a result of the 19 blacks and whites that was held in contempt for carrying on a protest against Jefferson Bank. Jefferson Bank, back in the day, and I'm talking about back around 1963, it was considered as a black bank. Although it was in the black community, but it was owned by whites. And of course, as a result of the protest that occurred in East St. Louis around the banking industry, whereby East St. Louis decided to take on the banks there, not hiring blacks. And within about 6 weeks or so, they came. They brought about change there in East St. Louis. And so as a result of that put the spotlight on Jefferson Bank as to why it had moved from Jefferson and Franklin to Jefferson and Washington. And as a result of such, they didn't have any blacks early on. And consequently, the group decided that, well, since it was considered as a black bank, being that the black community was putting money into the bank and keep it established as such, that maybe they need to have hire, maybe they need to hire at least four black tellers. And so as a result of the demand on the bank, and of course, the disruption that took place on August the 30th, right after the March on Washington in 1963, the bank got this court injunction against CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, from carrying on a protest against the bank. And of course, the disruption of the bank, with many folks that arrived from the March on Washington, joined us at the bank to carry on a disruption inside the bank. And so as a result, the white power structure, they then hailed who they thought that was the leadership of CORE responsible for the working class element going into the bank and stopping the service. So that's how the first nine people, they were past chairpersons of action and not action of CORE.
Four.
And as a result, they rounded them up at midnight after the demonstration. And then that excited the whole entire black community with that midnight arrest. And so, so it went. And then, as a result, the whole entire community, working class, as well as the professional element in the black community, people came together And then there were fair-minded whites that came up that participated and became involved in the protests. As a matter of
So
fact, among the 19 that spent time in jail, there were some black, white students and other white professionals.
fast forward, Percy, if we think about the fact that they did end with some amount of victory, they did hire black folks, and eventually
Eventually,
that
yeah.
they moved over to Jefferson and Market, and that's where we continue to hold protest every year. But what should people who never heard about Jefferson Bank remember about that struggle?
Well, I think that they should remember that it was not a struggle where all you did was exercise in chin music, and meaning talking. This was one that you have to engage in some civil disobedience, whereby you had to initiate a certain amount of disruption of the power structure to get their attention that the element that is protesting mean business, and that they're not going to continue to do business as usual or continue to profit as a result of exercising racism or racial discriminatory practices, that that the practice of racial discrimination has to become a liability rather than an asset. And so when CORE then began to not just call for the community to withdraw its money from Jefferson Bank, but at the same time, I mean, we had to engage in a certain amount of disruption to let the bank know that this type of activity is going to continue, and therefore keeping the spotlight on their practices and the fact that St. Louis now have an element, a group that is not just only going to talk and beg for jobs, but we're going to demand that we get some of those jobs. Otherwise, they're not going to continue to do business as usual. And I think that that's what is missing since that particular time, for all practical purposes. I mean the power structure, racism is it's a matter of business. And so as long as the establishment feel as if that they can satisfy the white community by not hiring any blacks, then they're going to do so. Now
So
the
Percy, I'm a let Ashley and Tiffany might have been too young when it was happening, but she may have heard about it. So Ashley, what do you think is the legacy of Jefferson Bank?
I think the legacy of Jefferson Bank is we got to keep fighting and actually make demands for our community and build the coalition to make those demands happen. I know from just protesting with Jefferson Bank and doing the protest every year, it wasn't just labor coming out, or it wasn't just black people. It was a coalition. People were lawyers, people were doctors, people were regular people that cleaned up. Some of the people remember their parents being teachers and coming out. And so the legacy is community and the community coming to back other black workers. And I think that's still important that the community shows up to help demand from the corporations, or this, for instance, was a bank, to make that demand for better jobs and demand that where we spend our dollars, you all respect us and hire us. And
Absolutely.
I still think we are figuring that out. Like, look at this Target boycott. Where we spend our dollars, you have to respect us. And I think that was also a big part of it.
Yeah. Tiffany, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I don't have much to say, but I was born in 81, and right here in St. Louis, but moved to Oklahoma before I even turned 1 year old. So I'm not 100% familiar with too much history of St. Louis. I Googled you, Mr. Percy,
Yeah,
before
I
this.
noticed you smile. I saw you smiling when I said disruption and whatnot.
Just because I did want to be familiar with what was going on, and being wet behind the ears in this movement and human rights movement, labor, civil rights movement. I think we all need to know the history, where we come from, so we can know where we're going. And movements are constant. We're constantly moving. So even if the people before us fought and didn't even see the end result, they left a pathway for us to continue on where they left off. And so that's the importance of acknowledging this time frame. August 30th, too, that's my birthday. I shouldn't have known that. You should know everything, but yeah, if it's anything, this is something that should be everywhere, in every history book, in every school. It gives me, I guess, put fire under my feet to know I'm on the right side of history. Because
Absolutely.
everything that Mr. Percy and everything that was done before, that's something that I can connect with. That's what's something that I want to be a part of. That's something I want my 21-year-old son to be able to say, yeah, my mom was on that side. And so if it's constantly shared and put out there, maybe more people would jump on it and continue on with the movement.
So I think when you say that, it's so powerful because that exactly is the legacy that people need to know, that they're standing on the shoulders of other people who fought that fight, like a Percy Green, like a Bill Clay, like some of the other folks. And I think we did a grand job of keeping it alive for 60 something years. So when you start to Google Jefferson Bank, some of those demonstrations are going to come up that we were doing. And I think that's powerful in and of itself because we always highlighted a number of the local or national workers' issues. So we were always linking, the Jefferson Bank with a current struggle so that people know that these are not disconnected. These are not like in silos. This is a continuous struggle for working rights, for working families, for the working class. One of the things I think we need to also be mindful of is the lessons learned, because each time I write about the Jefferson Bank, I learned some new and different stuff. And the last thing I wrote about it, I talked about how, as Percy calls it, the white power structure, how they united and circled around those protests in a way that was very memorable, because you had an incestuous relationship of the bank president with the prosecutor's office. And so that's how those injunctions came about. But you also had the white media really negative about the protests. So all of them working together really could have put a kibosh on that struggle, but the people were so powerful they were able to transcend that. And so I think when you start to look at a Jefferson Bank as a case study, all of those things will come into play.
That's the key term, Jamala. It should be folks that become involved into the protest movement, may they be black or white, need to look upon the Jefferson Bank protest as a case study or whatnot. I mean, it's not like everything went perfect
No,
there,
no,
but for
no,
all
no.
practical purposes and whatnot, it shows you how how the class thing, we had blacks at that particular time that was, looked upon as conservative. They was kind of away from the working class, but as a result of this particular situation, the way the white power structure behaved, forced both black and whites, the professionals as well as the working, together for them to realize that we were just one people, regardless of whether you had degrees or not, you were still an element of the working class.
Right.
That's a lesson. That's a lesson that we all need to be reminded of every so often, because see, we have people at various stages in their life become aware of racial discrimination, or let's say the depth of racial discrimination. Then you got new people being born. It's like well, I forgot. Yeah,
Tiffany.
Tim was here. Just like she, I mean, you know, she was saying she wasn't even born at the time of all of that. And so you have many others not aware of this particular situation. And so therefore, I mean, it ought to be taught in the elementary schools or whatnot. It needs to be taught in the churches. I mean, you think that they talk about everything? Well, all right.
Keep it clean, keep it clean. So
You
let
know
me
where
just
I'm
say
going
this,
with that.
Percy. Let me just say this. I think the point that you're making is poignant, and that one of the things that we should remember as a lesson is how vindictive they can be when they need to make an example. Because
Yeah.
some of those sentences were really long, and some of it meant that people lost their jobs. So
Yeah.
when I think about that, I think about the fact that when we do these strikes, we do these protests, that we need to keep in mind what the consequences could be and
Yeah.
be prepared for that. And so I know that that was a lesson you all learned in action, to always have bail money ready. People understood what to do
Yeah.
if they should get arrested. So to me, that's something to be passed on to the younger
Yeah.
organizers too. I want to go fast forward to the current thing, and just recently we had a right-wing appellate court pretty much say that the National Labor Relations Board is unconstitutional. Now, who would have thought that? So that pretty much is going to wipe that out. But also, what has happened recently, that Trump nullified the right of 400,000 workers at the Veteran Hospital to collectively bargain and to have room union representation, despite the agreements from the courts telling them that they could. So this man is he's being like rabid about like how he's coming after them. And then we already know that we had lawmakers like Governor Kehoe overturn one of the most popular things on the 2024 ballot, Prop A, which was going to increase the state's minimum wage, as well as, this is unprecedented, you all, paid sick leave by workers. So, when we start to see that was the will of the people, over 60% of Missouri voters said, yes, we want that. And then in a swoop of a pen or the gavel, they said, uh-uh, y'all don't need that. So when I think about that, all of that, plus what's going on with Project 25, really just undercutting collective bargaining, particularly for public sector workers, making all of the working conditions worse, because now you can't hardly say anything to these people that own these companies because they've been deregulated. I mean, there's just a frontal assault, side assault. I mean, we just reeling with all of these things. And so for us, I'm wondering, how should we be responding as supporters of workers' rights groups and unions, but also as a community? Anybody can jump in.
You prepare for war in time of peace. I mean, and by there, I mean, first of all, work toward getting yourself out of unnecessary debt. Begin to start you a little backup savings to the extent of an emergency type savings. You know what I mean? Because here's the deal. This is serious business. It's all about economics. Some agree with that and some not, but that's another time we'll debate that. But the point I'm making is that you cannot talk back to the boss, begin to share idea contrary to the establishment if you are if you are a slave to it. And when I say that you're a slave to it, when I say by that I mean you You were afraid that you're going to lose your job, and you're afraid of losing your job because if you
I
lose your
saw him. I
job,
say,
you can't pay
I
the
called
rent.
upstairs. I'm finna go with my cousin. I called upstairs. I say,
Can't do a whole bunch of things that you would can't live comfortably if you're in debt and with all these bills coming in on you. So I'm saying that basically, I'm not saying that you're going to ever get rid of all of the debt, but what I'm saying is that such debt as going into debt to celebrate Christmas, going into debt to celebrate these holidays, that money should be set aside in your little emergency fund. Everyone should have one, whether they're involved in the protest movement or not. That's what I think that needs to be done in terms of preparing for war in time of peace.
I'm going to ask
Yeah.
Tiffany because you are part of a public sector worker, and this seems almost counterintuitive that the government would be coming after government workers. But we have seen that. I mean, it's been hundreds, tens of thousands of folks who have been fired, let go, whatever, by this administration in the last 8 months. And so, how is FGE responding to these attacks?
Black workers, a ton of black workers.
Yeah.
Well, AFGE, we encourage our members that we try to let them know that we're still here because we have leadership telling everybody that there's no union, there's no contract, so you got to do this and you got to do that because you can't have no representative. We have to go behind that and say there is a union. You can have a representative. You can file grievances. You can do this. You know, it's a constant cleaning up what they're messing up. And I know that some of the information is being sent down from, you know, the Secretary of the VA. So if, like Mr. Percy said, if you got something to lose, you're gonna shut up. You're just gonna do what they say do. But for the people who don't mind losing it, I'm gonna speak up anyway. If I see that my rights are being violated, even when we have only our contract, our VA handbook to go by, I'm gonna read that word for word, every single piece of it. And they have to abide by that just like we do. And so now, since temporarily our contract is terminated, we have other means of holding management accountable and holding ourselves accountable. And so what we have to do is get right church and let's go home. So if our members is not doing what they're supposed to do, we have to tighten our SHOT group up too. And then when it comes to the agency, you all have to abide by the law and the policy that you put into place because even though we don't have a contract temporarily, I keep saying, that doesn't mean that management or different agencies can do whatever they want to do. They have been empowered by this temporary removal of our contract. So we are just really trying to push. I'm a union representative. I also do equal employment opportunity representation. And that time is statutory time, not union time, as they call it. So even with that, we didn't push back. And so, but we still have appeal processes, and it's just trying to find a way to get everybody into the know. Everybody, we have so many federal government workers that just listening to we don't have a union. So they're getting out. They're leaving and saying, what is the point in being in? I mean, the union is more than just standing next to you and fighting for your case. We have issues that affect in our community and our homes that we bring our struggle to work. And that's a mitigating factor when you're trying to take care of somebody. So it's not so our main push is to encourage members that we are still here. We're still active. We may not come into the meeting saying we're a union representative, but we can come into the meeting saying we're a personal representative. And on this end, we do have attorneys that is doing what they got to do. Is lawsuits being filed? We have national grievances out there. We have a bill, HR 2550, that we are sponsoring and asking people to, you know, protect their members of Congress to co-sponsor on that bill, because it will reverse this and we could restore our collective bargaining agreement.
So I'm looking at Ashley, because Missouri Jobs with Justice is unique in that it's not just labor unions that are in there. It's community people, it's faith leaders. It's a pretty broad coalition. And so I'm wondering, with all of the attacks going on, how is an organization like yours, which, you know, I'm a member of, I think both Percy and I are part of the Workers' Rights
Board. I think all of you
are. Yeah. How do you all see amplifying the voices of workers, particularly ones that are under attack like this? Because I could see how devastating it would be if you get told you don't have a contract, you don't have union representation, and people will say, well, yeah, what is the point to Tiffany's thing? And where do you go from there? And you get this draining of union members leaving the unions.
Yeah. So that's funny, because I asked Smiley, who is the big executive director of Missouri, of Jobs with Justice, not Missouri Jobs with Justice.
The national, yeah.
Yeah, the national. I posed that same question because they're not bargaining contracts right now. So many people, there are so many fights. The Teamsters have fights. AFG has fights. Boeing has fights. They are not going to the table and bargaining with these people because they know that there's no NRLB in place. And Jobs with Justice created the Workers' Rights Board for the last time this happened, I think, under the Bush administration. And so I think what we're going to see is, I know our Chicago Jobs with Justice has started having online Workers' Rights Board hearings, just to give people a place to grieve their grievances around the bargaining or the lack thereof bargaining that they have on their jobs right now. Like, it is not just ICE show up at your job, but they can just also just fire you for no reason. And I know some of the coalitions are trying to figure that out. But here at Missouri Jobs with Justice, since they repealed Proposition A and folks lost the cost of living adjustment, and folks lost their earned paid sick time starting tomorrow, we made a concerted effort to go out and talk to some of these folks in corporations around, hey, did you know you received this earned paid sick time? They paid it to you. No, they didn't pay you anything. You earned it. It's earned paid sick time, and you have the choice to use it. I don't know if you're going to lose it, but please use it before August 28th. Having those conversations, so many people didn't know they got it. Didn't know. They knew that the governor did something, but they weren't clear what the governor did. So that start a whole nother conversation with, well, if they're not going to listen to the will of the people, then what are we doing here? And what we're seeing is this billion-dollar grab, right? These billionaires, these lawsuits, paying these people to repeal things like the earned paid sick time and the cost of living adjustment so we can have a quality of life, but also the grab at democracy right now so they can keep on the way at our civil rights wins, at our labor wins, all of that stuff. And they're going to do whatever they can do. Sure, we can't bargain. We can't vote. We can't do a lot of things.
Well, would you do anything different if he was in that position?
You said what?
Would you do anything different if he was in their position?
If I was in whose position? The working? I am working.
In the establishment position.
Well, we're not trying to amplify their voices. They're pretty strong right now.
Well,
but I'm also thinking about like an entity like the AFL-CIO. Like, how are they taking all of these assaults and trying to sort through them to see what is our strategic path to viability for our unions?
Let me tell you the reason why. Because there is massive confusion, even on the side of us that are fighting.
I think it's still massive racism.
Well, that too, but I'm just saying those that are fighting, because it's a matter of fighting and being effective as opposed to, and then you have to make sure that you're fighting for the right thing. So you have a whole, that's why it's important to have this therapeutic in a brain exercise about what in the hell are we fighting for?
Yeah.
And why are we fighting? And then are we in a position to fight? See, a lot of time, I mean, there are questions that we have to ask from within before we go out there and talk about fighting. You can't go bear hunting with a toothpick.
No, but what they're finding is they got all their members fighting, and then the company is not going to the bargaining table.
Well, the company not going to the bargaining table because they know that the opposition is weak. The only time that you go to the bargaining table is if you have an adversary that can land a right-hand punch upside your head. But it's
See, Percy, that's why I'm saying, what is the role now of the AFL-CIO, who is the umbrella organization of all of these unions, to say, wait a minute, let's find a strategic way to make somebody an example, so they understand that we come in and we're gonna be strong and we're gonna stand together.
Right,
and
right,
I don't
right.
I don't think I really hear anything. And maybe Tiffany,
well,
you are here. That's part of it, but you know, we still got this umbrella organization that encompasses all of these unions. So what are you hearing from the AFL-CIO leadership, Tiffany, as a AFG person?
I can say it is 63 unions under AFL-CIO, and within the different states, we have central labor councils, and that's all of the unions come together, and we talk about these issues. We bring flyers, whatever we have to have that's based on our issue in our different areas, we bring it to the table, and we say, support us in this. And collectively, we go out and support in whichever way that we can support. And that's kind of what we're doing. And that's the way that it can spread like wildflowers. We have delegates that meet up, get the mic, talk about what's affecting, what's the hugest impact with our union, and we share it with our other union.
Let me tell you how they used to do with the union to be effective. Mm-hmm. Unions used to respect other unions that are on strike. When a union is on strike, the other unions would not cross it. Now, you don't hardly hear any of that nowadays. You have Boeing out there, and you still see a certain amount of trucks and transportation going inside to service McDonald's. Back in the day, that was a code. When a company is on strike, you
don't cross the line. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's the first thing that you could do. And then that brings pressure on the company. If the company can't continue to operate as usual, then of course they're gonna have to negotiate with the people on strike. But as long as they can still get those scabs to come in there. And, you know, you got some of the union people that are they're in so much debt that they have to cross the picket line to go in there to work for Chuck.
Well, that's an old divide and conquer that's always been used. But it seems to me that...
But I'm just saying that...
I hear what you're saying, Percy.
About organized labor, maybe it takes someone like you to start beating the drum about, hey, why aren't other unions supporting other unions when they're on strike?
And
as
that's
basic as that.
I think it's basic and it's necessary. What I want us to focus on now is really to talk about we in a different political moment. And what does that mean when you have an authoritarian government that is wreaking havoc and undermining American families, let alone unions, because the unions have been central to working class victory, so that the standard of living is good. You know, you have good working conditions at work. All of that stuff is getting ready to implode. And so I'm wondering and trying to see deep into these unions if people understand the historic moment that we're
No,
in,
many
and
of
it's
them don't.
authoritarian one. And I just want to read something. Bill Fletcher, who is a friend of ours, and somebody that we respect, recently had an article in These Times called "The Labor Movement is in a Fight for Its Existence Against a Neo-Fascist Threat." So here's the last thing, the last line of that article says, and I want us to react to it. Trade unionism must be anti-fascist, or it will be nothing at all. So what he's saying is, like, we don't understand this moment and start to reshape our strategy and tactics, then to your point, Percy, we nothing is going to happen, and unions will die, or they'll be so diminished that they won't be effective. So is that the point that would make us have some leaps and bounds in the way that we are organizing right now, that we understand this is a different moment? This is not like 1980 when, you know, the food came in there and disrupted all the workers who were doing the FAA. This is a moment where this person, every single civil and human rights is being like snatched away. So given that we are in this moment, and if people believe we are in this moment, maybe they don't. Maybe that's part of the problem. How do we move our unions and worker centers, worker organizations, to understand this is a different moment that we're in?
So this is a question that I posed at our national convening this year. Is the lack of organizing because of the rising majority, or not organizing because of the rising majority? So racism so hard, where Black people have been thriving in these unions for so many years that now there is just no interest to us going, because we've seen them get weaker and weaker and weaker throughout like years. And so many of their members voted for the man with the dead hand, as some people call him. So many of those members voted for them. So now they're in this FAFO moment of, oh my God, we for this man, and now my pension's leaving. Now my medicines cost more. Now this. And so if not history, if we know that the unions were set up for a certain group of people to get certain jobs with them, what is the new worker entity that we are setting up where people can bargain and still thrive? Because I don't know if we can save that entity.
What,
I don't know.
you don't think the union is going to be saved?
I think an entity that was set up to keep my grandfather from not plumbing, set up to keep my people thriving now. Think there has to be another entity set up.
Well, I mean,
So an alternative to the union? Yes,
in other words, back
I
home.
think we have to set up either these worker centers have to start thriving in almost a union-esque way, but that.
Think black folks, you don't think the union, you don't think black folks can,
Mean, that's all we got to fight right now.
well, how, do you think the black folks should organize a separate union?
I didn't say a separate union. I think all folks should organize a new entity. There has to be a new entity.
Interesting concept. Tiffany wanted to jump in. Go ahead, Tiffany.
I think opinions can be saved. I
I
went
think so.
to the Labor Faith Alliance breakfast, and anytime I see faith, I have hope. And so even back in the day, there were churches that union people had their meetings in. So if it's any type of collaboration that needs to be done, maybe the churches can come back to the forefront of this fight and stand with us. And so this is not, you know, like I've been saying, I've never been in a fight before and never got punched. And so we just got punched right now and it hurt. But that don't mean that the fight is over. It just mean we need them heavy hitters
You need
to
to
come
engage.
in and
You
help.
need
And
to
it ain't
engage.
nothing stronger, ain't no heavy hitter stronger than the foundation of a church. And I don't care if it's the Baptist Church of God in Christ, Methodist, if we can get the religious organization into it as well as the unions and our community. This is lottie dottie everybody. I know I use a lot of military lane, you know, I'm also a veteran. So this is hidden in all areas. Shoot, that
Yeah.
this affecting my care at the VA. I don't want y'all tampering around with employees just working on me, you
Yeah,
know. And
we
so
right.
this is something, it's different organizations out there that unions are connected with, coalitions that unions are connected with. And it's nothing stronger than everybody on the front line fighting together. We don't wait
Yeah.
to the small army get up there and fight. We just all come and blitzing all at one time. And the so one of the questions is, how does all of that get out there to the masses? And how, I mean, they did it back in the day. And I know if they did it back then, we can do it now. So
Yeah,
and, I don't
and
know.
we had less
We had to do
internet
some
and all of
boxing
that
with the
back then.
churches, but that's it.
But here's the thing that Tiffany, you remind me of, even in terms of the churches. It seems like any organized entity, particularly with Black folks, because that's the community I'm most familiar with, almost all of those ways and entities that we had organizing ourselves are under attack. So when I look at Black churches, they have diminishing congregations. A lot of them have shuttered. If you go through North St. Louis, you see lots of churches that are no longer there. And so when we start to look at, okay, who's left and who's willing to fight, those are the people I think we have to really get into the fold. So I really have been advocating for a mass educational campaign of not just Black people, but working class people, because we have been drinking the Kool-Aid for so damn long that we don't know right from wrong and good from bad. You know, we just like keep getting knocked around or whatever somebody says. We say, oh yeah. Then somebody else say, oh yeah. And so there has to be a clear voice, a reason saying, here's the path, here's our strategy. And I think that's what people don't see. They don't see a rallying cry of the majority of people that's going to come together to be a fighting entity against fascism.
Remember, I
Because
said up
now
front,
is the time for that.
confusion. I said about confusion. You have much of the leadership is confused, many of the leaders know what they don't know. You got all of this other confusion underneath. That's why now the question is, it's almost like many of the folks in the movement is looking for a messiah to have something to tell them what they need to do. And for them,
It ain't gonna happen.
and for that to sound so good that they're willing to follow. But the point is that when you start utilizing deductive reasoning, utilizing deductive reasoning, that is, what it takes for people to survive in our society as we know it. It's not rocks, it's not all of this other. All of the elements that we're talking about here, they need some form of economics, money. Well, who controls the money? Any of those folks that are struggling for money control anything?
Oh no.
Most of the overwhelming majority of the so-called working people, even the so-called professional,
So,
they're taxes.
Percy, what would be a strategy that would mobilize the greatest number of workers and working people? What's the strategy?
What would be strategy?
Right. Because I think part of what I'm
Education, see,
seeing
right?
and And
First of
hearing
all,
is like there's so much going on. Like, do
well,
this.
first,
here's my struggle.
you,
here's
you're right.
my.
That's what.
You got to do this. No, we got.
Well,
some
that's
of those
where the
have to be
education.
central.
That's where the education comes in. You know, that's the reason why I'm saying that the protest, civil disobedience. See, people learn the quickest based upon a pictorial, pictures they can see. The academics that you can read about, that's okay. I don't want to belittle that. But the point is that when you see something and touch something, that has a greater amount of influence than someone say, well, go read about the revolution of so-and-so. So that's what I'm saying. That's why it's important to carry on the protest, because most of the people are not going to come on board unless they see some drama.
Yeah.
So you recognize the drama.
Yeah, I get that.
But once you do that, Jamala, you can't do one particular incident and think that the folks that observe that one incident, that they're going to clearly understand it.
Not what I'm saying. I'm saying a strategy is different from tactics.
Sustain.
There are going to be multiple tactics, but what is the main strategy that we should be organized
around economics?
Okay, that's not a strategy. That's a concept. Let
right.
me just say this, because Percy, we only got a few minutes left, and I want there's some important actions that are there's some important actions coming up, and so. One of them is for Labor Day, so I want Ashley to talk about that, and then Tiffany, if GE has something coming up, because I definitely want our listeners to do that. It ain't gonna be real quick.
I want to say real quick, we need to support the organized strike out there at Boeing.
Yes.
And those that are observing, I'm saying that we need to support organized labor.
Yes.
That should be the first strike. That should be a strategy.
And that's a tactic, right? That's a tactic. But I agree with it. That's a tactic.
All right,
so that's going on now, and those workers need to see us. So
yes.
Yeah. So let's make those announcements.
All right. So on Labor Day here in St. Louis, we'll meet at Shaw Park at noon to some of the workers' struggles that are going on, talk about the repealing of Prop A, and there's gonna be a highlight of, again, another labor fight with our brothers and sisters at SEIU, Local 1, bargaining for their janitorial wages. And so again, that's at Shaw Park at noon on Labor Day. And then on September 17th, we are going out to the Machinist Lodge to go on strike with the Boeing workers. We want to take a big group out there on September 17th. And before September 17th, on September 10th, we go
down to Jeff City.
Oh, what day?
September 10th. We're going down to Jeff City to try to stop Trump's gerrymandering scheme. And let them know that our democracy is not for sale, and they cannot redistrict us outside of this. Leave us alone.
Let me ask
you this. Wait, Percy. Tiffany's got an announcement, because we only got 2 minutes left. So,
this would be real quick. It's just supporting the HR 2550 bill, the Protect America's Workers Act.
Is anyone stopping them scabs out there are they stopping anything out there?
We'll figure that out. But Tiffany, we should call our representatives, tell them to support.
Number again?
HR 2550.
Okay.
And it should restore our collective bargaining agreement.
And tell people what collective bargaining is, because I don't know that people really understand that unless you're a union person, and sometimes even the union people don't understand.
Right.
So what is a collective bargaining?
It's actually this book right here.
Oh, there you go. give me some examples.
Just real quick.
This book have 67 articles in it.
Yeah, give me some example of a collective bargaining.
Okay, so for one, I say conditions of employment, where right now we have employees, and I can say, I'm not gonna say her name, but
You're bargaining
every,
for rights
but
of the workers.
Percy, let her
yeah.
finish because we gotta cut out of here.
African American female, single mom, worked a shift for 9 years. After this agreement was temporarily terminated, so was her shift. So they just told her, oh, you're gonna start working this shift now. And or else, because there's no contract. Normally, with this book, they would come in and say, hey, we have to come to the table on this change because this can affect her work-life balance. This can affect anything. Let's see the pros and cons before we go jumping and switching people's shift. But now that this is temporarily out of order, change, and she have 3 children. And she was in a position where, and she was working remote. That was counts. Everything just changed after this contract was temporary.
So, Tiffany, I think you need to probably do a little mini workshop on that. We are definitely out of time. And, I want to thank all my guests today, Percy Green the second, Tiffany McPherson, and Ashley
Absolutely.
Bolden. For anybody that wants to see or hear previous shows, please go to jamalarogers.com. Some of these things are also on my YouTube page, so don't get left out. And we hope you continue this discussion about workers' rights, workers' struggles in the age of neo-fascism. Thank you all, and I'll see you on the battlefield.
Do the right
We've got
thing.
To do it.